Today is Wednesday, April 29th, 2026, and you're listening to the World Socialist Website. Charles III in Washington, Monarchy, Oligarchy, and the Repudiation of 1776, by Joseph Kishore. On the eve of the 250th anniversary of American independence, the British monarch, Charles III, addressed a joint session of the United States Congress on Tuesday. Charles, the great-great-great-great-great-grandson of King George III, against whom the American Revolution was fought, was received with full ceremonial honors by the ruling class and its two political parties. The White House, summarizing the attitude and aspirations of Trump, posted a photo of Trump and Charles together Saturday afternoon under the caption, "Two Kings." The spectacle began Tuesday morning at the White House, where Charles was feted with a 21-gun salute and participated with Trump in the Reviewing of the Troops, the highest diplomatic honor for a visiting head of state. After a private Oval Office meeting, Charles proceeded to Capitol Hill, becoming only the second British monarch ever to address a joint session of Congress. In the evening, the King and Queen Camilla were honored at a white-tie banquet in the White House State Dining Room, with a guest list personality curated by Trump and populated by the oligarchs whose wealth and power constitute the real monarchy in America. Among those attending were Paramount CEO David Ellison, Amazon's Jeff Bezos, Apple's Tim Cook, NVIDIA's Jensen Huang. They dined on Dover sole and spring-herbed ravioli, alongside Trump's fascist cabinet members and a host of right-wing media personalities and venture capitalists. From the standpoint of British imperialism, the visit was aimed at shoring up to the somewhat strained special relationship between the US and UK. Charles' address to Congress was packaged in the usual royal idiom of empty homilies about peace and friendship, anchored in the Christian faith, the wrapping for the real concern transmitted through the 77-year-old monarch, war. Charles boasted of the, quote, biggest sustained increase in British military spending since the Cold War, and made a specific point of encouraging the continued commitment of the United States to the conflict against Russia in Ukraine. The same Democrats who tweeted their insincere support for no kings rose to applaud a real king the moment he spoke of war. Charles devoted some time in referencing the shared bond of the two countries, expressed in the production of fighter jets, submarines, and other instruments of destruction. Trotsky once observed that the British bourgeoisie had adapted, quote, the old royal and noble castle to the requirements of the business firm, a description that retains all its force today. The monarchy functions as an ideological prop of British capitalism, even as the royal household is steeped in corruption and scandal. Charles' brother and Trump's friend, Prince Andrew, has been directly implicated in the Epstein sexual abuse network and forced out of public duties, while the disclosures surrounding Epstein have exposed the international network of wealth and criminality that links monarchy, finance, intelligence agencies, and the global ruling elite. Charles declined to attend a meeting with survivors of Epstein, held by Democratic Representative Ro Khanna, though this did not prevent Khanna from joining his fellow Democrats, Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez among them, in paying tribute to the king. But the more fundamental significance of Charles' visit lies in the American context. The grotesque spectacle exposes the relationship of the American ruling class to the revolutionary tradition it has long since repudiated. The American Revolution established the world's first major bourgeois democratic republic on the basis of Enlightenment principles. The Constitution's prohibition of titles of nobility, contained in Article 1, Section 9 and 10, was a conscious rejection of the social principle that birth confers authority and that the masses must bow before dynastic power. Thomas Paine, whose common sense helped give political form to the American Revolution, poured scorn on the hereditary monarchy. Quote, "One of the strongest natural proofs of the folly of hereditary right in kings," he wrote, "is that nature disapproves it. Otherwise, she would not so frequently turn it into ridicule by giving mankind an ass for a lion." End quote. An appropriate future epitaph for both the honoree and the host of yesterday's events. The visit of this representative of the British monarchy takes place under an administration that has repudiated, in word and deed, the democratic principles of 1776. The Bill of Rights has been trampled underfoot, and the grievances listed in the Declaration of Independence against King George III read like a rap sheet for the present occupant of the White House. Trump has mobilized the cultural sensibilities of the criminal underworld to the task of remaking the institution of power based on the monarchical principle. He has demolished the East Wing of the White House to make way for a 90,000-square-foot Versailles-style ballroom, a monument to personal rule. He has sought to stamp his signature on the dollar bill, place his profile on a gold coin, rename the Kennedy Center, and convert every institution of the state into an instrument of personal glorification. Trump, however, speaks and acts not just for himself, but as a representative of an oligarchy that regards constitutional restraints and democratic rights as intolerable obstacles to the defense of its wealth. This is evident in the official response to Charles' visit. The media fawned over the monarch, treating his banalities as a profound statement of democratic principle. The Democratic Party and the liberal press have spent years through the New York Times 1619 Project and related efforts, depicting Jefferson, Washington, and Lincoln as little more than racial villains. Yet, they now bow before the living embodiment of hereditary privilege. Their problem was never with oppression as such, but with the revolutionary traditions that might inspire opposition to the present order. Mamdani, the Democratic Socialist of America mayor of New York, is playing his assigned role as well, appearing with Charles today at a commemoration of the September 11 attacks. The Democrats do not oppose dictatorship because they defend the same class interests that are driving the turn to authoritarianism. In his work, The Persistence of the Old Regime, historian Arno Meyer described the way in which European society before 1914 fused bourgeois wealth with monarchical, aristocratic, and ecclesiastical forms. The bourgeoisie adapted itself to the old regime, even as it transformed the economic foundations beneath it. This alliance was ruptured only by the First World War, the Russian Revolution, and the revolutionary upheavals that followed. A similar dynamic prevails today, in somewhat different form. The American oligarchy has accumulated wealth on a scale without precedent in human history. Its central political occupation is how this wealth will be defended, legally, ideologically, and physically, against the social opposition generated by its own accumulation. The result is the revival of aristocratic forms. The oligarchs want deference. They want immunity. They want the masses to know their place, to bow and scrape when in the presence of their betters. They want inherited wealth and dynastic privilege to be recognized not only in fact, but in social practice and political culture. The constitutional prohibition on titles of nobility is being prepared for repudiation in practice, even if not yet in text. When Trump posts two kings, he's absolutely serious. It is a declaration of intent by a president and the social forces behind him which are seeking to establish the principles of hereditary rule and untrammeled executive power, enforced through the paramilitary police agencies of the state and the mobilization of fascist gangs. Behind Trump stands Elon Musk, Larry Ellison, Jeff Bezos, Mark Zuckerberg, the Wall Street financiers, the tech monopolists, and the private equity barons whose wealth dwarfs that of any historical monarch. Their fortunes are measured not in palaces, estates, and crown jewels, but in hundreds of billions of dollars, vast corporate empires, control over communication systems, military contracts, artificial intelligence, logistics, finance, and the commanding heights of social life. The No Kings demonstration of June and October 2025 and March 2026, the last drawing some 8 million participants, expressed, however incoherently, the mass opposition to the revival of monarchical and dictatorial forms. But these mobilizations cannot be left in the hands of the Democrats, who seek to channel popular anger back into the framework of capitalist politics. The danger is not merely Trump as an individual. It is the oligarchic order that produced him. Charles declared in his address that the Anglo-American relationship is, quote, a partnership born out of dispute. In this way, he sought to reduce what was a revolutionary struggle against monarchy to a minor episode in the general triumph of reaction. But masses of people in the United States and internationally will draw very different conclusions and inspirations from this history. The defense of the democratic principles proclaimed in 1776 is impossible today outside of the fight for socialism. In the 18th century, the struggle against monarchy was bound up with the rise of the bourgeoisie and the creation of the democratic republic. In the 21st century, the defense and extension of democracy requires the expropriation of the financial oligarchy and the socialist reorganization of society on the basis of human need, not private profit. The revolutionary democratic principles of 1776 can be defended only by carrying them beyond the limits of bourgeois society. Today, Charles III is applauded in the Capitol. 251 years ago, at Lexington and Concord, ordinary people took up arms against the principles he embodies. The principles fought for then have not been extinguished. They live in the developing struggles of the international working class, which must now take conscious political form in the fight for socialism. Trump rushes migrant children through deportation courts while Waltz backs federal raids in Minnesota, by Jacob Cross. According to a CNN report published Tuesday, the Trump administration is seeking to fast-track the deportation of migrant children in U.S. custody by abruptly advancing immigration court hearings, in some cases by weeks or months, and with only days' notice. Children as young as 4 and 5 years old are being forced to appear repeatedly in immigration court, sometimes without legal counsel. Attorneys for the children warn that the rush schedule makes it far more difficult to obtain legal relief, including special immigrant juvenile status, which requires proceedings in state court before an application can be abdicated by federal immigration authorities. CNN reported that White House Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller recently pressed health and human service officials to move faster to get migrant children out of custody and return them to their countries of origin. The fascists in the Trump administration are presenting the policy in the language of rescue, claiming that the accelerated deportation will protect children from trafficking and exploitation. In reality, the policy places traumatized children, many of whom fled abuse, abandonment, poverty, or violence, on a fast track to removal before they can even understand the proceeding against them, much less secure counsel. What meaning does due process have when a 5-year-old is ordered into a court without a lawyer and expected to answer for themselves? The Fifth Amendment's guarantee of due process applies to persons, not only citizens. Yet the government is compelling traumatized children to participate in adversarial proceedings they cannot possibly understand, while accelerating deadlines so their attorneys cannot obtain relief. In the U.S. immigration system, there is no universal government-appointed counsel for children facing deportation. The official fiction is that these proceedings are civil, not criminal, and therefore do not trigger the same right to counsel as a criminal prosecution. But the practical consequence is that children are forced to defend themselves against trained government lawyers while facing exile, family separation, or return to poverty and violence. The same administration that refuses to release the Epstein files, pardons and commutes the sentences of fascist militia members, and wages a legal war around the world, is now pressuring immigrant children and families into abandoning their legal rights. This policy did not emerge suddenly. A January 13th policy brief by Kids in Need of Defense, or KIND, documented how the Trump administration has repeatedly justified attacks on immigrant children and their families as anti-trafficking measures. KIND wrote that the administration's enforcement efforts, quote, increasingly center the fear and devastation of separation as a strategy to advance deportation and to reduce immigration of children and families, end quote. The report warned that the government was, quote, significantly compromising children's safety, best interest, and critical legal protections, end quote. The KIND report documented how the Trump administration, quote, upended the reunification and release process, end quote, and eroded the distinction between the Office of Refugee Resettlement's child welfare mission and DHS's enforcement functions in order to, quote, target immigration enforcement against children and their sponsors and thwart or disrupt reunifications, end quote. KIND also documented the administration's use of so-called wellness checks and the UAC Safety Verification Initiative, measures to present it as efforts to locate children supposedly missing under the Biden administration. In reality, KIND wrote, these initiatives proceed, quote, almost exclusively from an immigration and law enforcement lens, with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, and Homeland Security Investigation, HSI, agents questioning children and caregivers, issuing removal notices, and in some cases, taking sponsors or children into custody. The figures cited by KIND underscore the scale of the operation. By November 2025, some 3,000 people had reportedly been arrested as part of GHS's initiatives targeting parents, legal guardians, and caretakers of migrant children, while HSI had arrested more than 450 sponsors of unaccompanied children. KIND also noted that some 600 children, the highest number on record, had been referred by ICE to Office of Refugee Resettlement, ORR, shelters. The same day CNN reported the administration's move to accelerate the deportation of children, federal agents carried out 22 raids across the Twin Cities as part of bogus investigations into alleged fraud in Minnesota's social welfare programs. The FBI and Homeland Security investigations executed the warrants, while the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehensions partnered with federal investigators and the State Attorney General's Medicaid Fraud Unit to participate in searches at autism-related facilities. These fraud investigations are a bogus pretext through which the Trump administration is seeking to justify sweeping attacks on the democratic rights of the working class, regardless of immigration status. For months, Trump has seized on allegations of fraud in Minnesota's social program to whip up a racist campaign against Somali immigrants and Somali Americans, denouncing them as garbage and demanding they be sent back to where they came from. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz responded not by opposing the federal operation, but by endorsing it. Quote, today's raids by state and federal law enforcement happened because our state agencies caught irregular behavior and reported it, Walz declared. That's how the system is supposed to work, and our agencies will keep at it as long as there are fraudsters around to put behind bars, end quote. In a separate post, Walz added that joint investigations work, while also calling for a joint investigation into the killings of Alex Pretty and Renee Nicole Good. This is a revealing admission the Democratic governor is boasting of the collaborations of state agencies with Kash Patel's FBI and other federal police forces under conditions in which the Trump administration has systematically inflated allegations of fraud in Minnesota to justify the federal occupation of the state and cut millions in federal funding. The raids are being used to lend legitimacy to the administration's broader claims that social programs are riddled with criminality and must be placed under police supervision or stripped of funding altogether. The real target is not fraud, but the social rights of the working class. Programs for children, the disabled, the poor, and immigrants are being treated as suspect and expendable, while hundreds of billions are funneled into war, repression, and the enrichment of the corporate oligarchy. As Trump himself said earlier this month while appointing Vice President J.D. Vance as his fraud czar, "Don't send any money for daycare because we're fighting wars." He added, quote, "You gotta let states take care of daycare, and they should pay for it too. Medicaid, Medicare, all these individual things." The only concern for the U.S. government, Trump stated, should be, quote, "one thing, military protection," end quote. Walls call for a joint investigation into the killings of Renee Nicole Good and Alex Preddy only underscore the fraudulence of his position. When federal agents killed Good in Minneapolis on January 7th, the FBI did not work transparently with Minnesota investigators. On Tuesday, the Daily Beast reported that Good's killer, ICE agent Jonathan Ross, has been quietly relocated to another state and allowed to resume work while the FBI investigation is stalled. Senior DHS officials told the outlet that ICE's own internal review cannot begin until the FBI probe is completed, effectively and conveniently, freezing the agency's accountability process. The report confirmed that the FBI's investigation into Good's death was compromised from the outset. FBI Supervisor Tracy Mergen resigned from the Minneapolis field office after saying she was pressured to reclassify her civil rights inquiry into Ross as an investigation into Good herself. Whistleblower accounts obtained by Senators Sheldon Whitehouse and Dick Durbin described FBI Director Patel as directing agents to reframe warrant language so that Good would be portrayed as a suspect rather than a victim. Multiple senior DHS officials also told the outlet that the decision to exclude Minnesota state investigators from federal evidence and the crime scene was directed by the White House. The real fraud is not in Minnesota clinics and daycare sites, but the claim that the American justice system, the police, and the immigration Gestapo exist to protect workers, children, and their families. These institutions are not neutral bodies that can be reformed into instruments of democracy. They are instruments of class rule, directed against the working class, immigrants, and all opposition to the policies of war and austerity. The defense of children, immigrants, and democratic rights requires the independent political mobilization of the working class against the capitalist system and both parties that defend it. Amid popular outrage, no official explanation of secret CIA operation in Mexico, by Andrea Lobo. The U.S. government has made clear that there will be no explanation, let alone apologies, after two CIA agents died in a road accident during a supposed anti-drug operation in the Mexican state of Chihuahua, an operation the Mexican federal government claims was carried out without its permission or even prior knowledge. The incident reportedly occurred at 2 a.m. in a remote area of the Sierra Madre Mountains when the vehicle veered off the road, crashed, and exploded. Initially, U.S. Ambassador Ronald Johnson, a former Green Beret and CIA officer, claimed the deceased were merely, quote, "members of staff from the United States Embassy," end quote. It was soon revealed, however, that the dead were not ordinary U.S. personnel, but CIA operatives engaged in a covert mission. The CIA officers are among the first fatalities in Trump's escalating war in Latin America, following the death in February of a Lance Corporal who fell off the USS Iwo Jima while conducting operations in the Caribbean. The political dimensions grew when Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum revealed that the four individuals in the vehicle were working jointly on a mission of which the federal government had not been informed. But as the U.S. government conducts policing and intelligence operations across the border without even notifying Mexican authorities, Sheinbaum's response has been remarkably restrained. She sent a letter to the U.S. Embassy requesting information. The pro-Trump Wall Street Journal gloated, quote, "She could have chosen to express outrage at an apparently egregious violation of Mexican sovereignty. Instead, she struck a muted response," end quote. The White House arrogantly dismissed this simple request. White House spokesperson Caroline Leavitt told Fox News that Trump was very displeased with Sheinbaum's reaction, adding, quote, "I think the president would agree that a little sympathy from Claudia Sheinbaum would be very meaningful for the two American lives that were lost," end quote. Mexico's security cabinet sank even further, all but apologizing in a carefully worded statement Saturday. After noting diplomatically that the operation violated Mexican law, it expressed, quote, "its deepest regret for the death of four individuals, two state personnel and two U.S. agents, during the accident that occurred in Chihuahua on April 19th, and extends its sincerest condolences and solidarity to their families, co-workers, and loved ones during this difficult time," end quote. The cabinet then affirmed, quote, "its willingness to maintain a close, serious, and respectful relationship with the government of the United States for the benefit of the security of both countries," end quote. Román Oseguera Cervantes, director of the Chihuahua State Investigation Agency, and his bodyguard, Manel Mendez, were also reportedly in the vehicle. Chihuahua is one of the few states governed by the right-wing opposition National Action Party, or PAN, and the governor, María Eugenia Maru Campos, has refused to provide information on the operation. Subsequent reporting has exposed the extent of U.S. covert activity. Two U.S. officials, speaking on condition of anonymity, to The Intercept, confirmed that the CIA has been running clandestine operations in Mexico, working alongside vetted state police forces and other agencies. According to these sources, the Americans died after a raid on a synthetic drug laboratory. It has also emerged that one agent entered Mexico on a tourist permit, and the other with a diplomatic passport. In contrast to Sheinbaum's response, the incident has raised alarm among the Mexican working class and broader population, as the Trump administration behaves with unrestrained violence and open criminality across the hemisphere and the world. In comments to the World Socialist website, an auto worker at General Motors Silao denounced U.S. intervention in Mexico and its wars globally, as well as the response of the Sheinbaum administration. Quote, "From the government, they support U.S. wars and the participation of corporations, which, in my case, is General Motors. The only opposition will come from the workers. It depends on the rank and file to oppose the policies of capitalism and stand against profiteering based on the suffering of others, which is what war and human need represent," end quote. The broader context underscores the urgency of this appeal. 1. The Pentagon has been conducting bombing operations on fishing boats in the Pacific and Caribbean since September, already claiming the lives of at least 186 innocent workers. 2. In January, U.S. bombs fell in the metropolis of Caracas, as part of an operation aimed at kidnapping Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. 3. In Ecuador, joint operations have involved burning and bombing farmers' homes and detaining and torturing agricultural workers. 4. Washington continues its war of annihilation against Iran and its support for the Israeli genocide in Gaza and destruction of Lebanon. 5. Last week, United States Southern Command Chief Francis L. Donovan launched the SOUTHCOM Autonomous Warfare Command, or SAWC, designed to deploy autonomous and unmanned systems across Latin America. 6. as Trump threatens Cuba is next after Iran. The island continues to be starved of oil, with the complicity of Sheinbaum and other regional governments. There are countless indications of the dangers directly faced by Mexico as a result of U.S. aggression. Last year, the U.S. State Department designated six Mexican cartels as foreign terrorist organizations, further laying the legal groundwork for military intervention. Immediately after the attack on Venezuela, Trump said, quote, "The cartels control Mexico," end quote, and threatened to carry out direct military operations inside the country. In a little-noticed move in January, United States Northern Command, or U.S. NORTHCOM, which covers Canada, the U.S., and Mexico, established the Joint Interagency Task Force Counter-Cartel, the JIATF-CC, to coordinate U.S. intelligence efforts to, quote, "identify, disrupt, and dismantle cartel networks," end quote. The White House marked the 250th anniversary of the Mexican-American War this year by celebrating it as a legendary conquest, shaping U.S. policy in the region today. Trump has effectively revived and expanded the Monroe Doctrine into what officials have dubbed a hemispheric war policy. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth has referred to this approach as the Greater North America Doctrine. In late February, the Mexican military killed Nemesio Oseguera, leader of the Jalisco New Generation Cartel, using intelligence from the FBI and CIA. The Los Angeles Times reported that Mexican officials feared that if they did not act, Trump might launch a unilateral raid on Mexican soil. Trump himself openly mused, "Could happen. Stranger things have happened," end quote. Brian Finnegan of the International Crisis Group told The Intercept that elements within the U.S. administration are eager to turn Mexico into a battlefield in a new, quote, "global war on terror," targeting cartels. The U.S. midterm election and FIFA World Cup, hosted by the U.S., Mexico, and Canada, heightens the danger of precipitous actions. The reality is that the United States conducts covert operations around the world without permission. As Carlos Perez Ricart, a researcher at Mexico's CIDE, explains, U.S. agents, quote, "operate, move, and make contacts without consulting the Mexican government, whether the federal government knew or not, is irrelevant, since it lacks the capacity to prevent or track these actions," end quote. What is pivotal is a response of both governments to this involuntary exposure. Washington has reaffirmed its presumed right to act unilaterally anywhere in the world. Meanwhile, Sheinbaum, who presents herself as a left nationalist defending sovereignty, continues to deepen Mexico's economic and military integration into U.S. war plans. Mexico already served as an essential supplier of military components for the Pentagon, participates in joint exercises with U.S. forces while hosting American trainers, and has joined the tariff war against China. Security Minister Omar Garcia Harfuch, a police official and heir to the capitalist political elite, has the deepest ties to U.S. security agencies and embodies this integration. His response has been to absurdly deny any ongoing U.S. intelligence operations in Mexico. The Mexican government has deployed National Guard troops to harass, kill, and deport migrants headed to the U.S. It has also carried out at least 92 extraditions of alleged traffickers to the U.S., violating Mexican constitutional protections. At the same time, Sheinbaum's admission that she was unaware of operations in a border state exposes more than a blind spot. It demonstrates that within the Mexican ruling class she represents, there is no constituency for opposing the U.S. drive to recolonize Mexico and Latin America. There is merely an eagerness and apprehension about securing a fair share of the profits from this process, including in the ongoing renegotiations of the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade deal. This is as far as Sheinbaum's talk of defending national sovereignty goes.
The World Socialist website is published by the International Committee of the Fourth International, the ICFI, the leadership of the World Socialist Movement, the Fourth International founded by Leon Trotsky in 1938. The World Socialist website relies entirely on the donations of readers and listeners for financial support. To give to the WSWS or to set up a regular monthly contribution, go to wsws.org/donate. We urge our listeners to join the International Committee of the Fourth International and one of its affiliated political parties and take up the struggle for socialism.